That's the thing, man. You really can't sit around waiting for people to come to you because, you know, they're busy doing other stuff, living their life. So you really, like, every opportunity I've ever had, I feel like it was a result of me just going out to somebody super cold and uncomfortably and being like, you know, can we work together? And 30% of the time they'll be like, yeah, sure. You know, 70% of the time they got something else going on, but that's just how it goes.
Hey guys, what is going on? This is your boy Los Carlos with the Motor Misfit Podcast. Thank you everyone for all the love. Thank you everyone for keeping on and listening to all these episodes, tuning in. I really appreciate it. And together we are definitely going to accomplish a lot. I wanted to keep this rolling with great content, great guests. And today we have such a really good guest, Luke Munno. He is an automotive and motorsport photographer, an editor, and a content creator. Luke takes us through his incredible journey of just basically moving out of his home state all the way to California and making it happen for himself. He's worked with many brands, well-known brands, and then set off on his own, where he is now an accomplished and highly sought after automotive and motorsports photographer. We're going to talk to Luke. I don't want to take too much time. Let's get into that episode. Let's go.
Yo, 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 what is up, everybody? This is your boy, Los. Thank you for tuning in to another Motor Misfit Podcast. Guys, today we have a great episode for you. I know you're going to be excited about this one. We have Luke Munno, an independent motorsports photographer. What is going on, Luke?
Oh, not too much. Glad to be here, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
I really appreciate you coming on, so thank you, man.
My pleasure.
So guys, Luke is an incredible Los Angeles-based photographer with years in the industry. When he moved from his hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 2007, he knew he wanted to go after his dreams and follow his passion for cars. From starting as a staff editor at Import Tuner to kickstarting Mazda's social media and content strategy, Luke has accomplished so much, and much, much more is to come. Today, he photographs, writes, and works on automotive national ad campaigns. We are chatting with him so he can take us through his journey and provide some great advice and insight. I'll pass it over to him, and he can share a little bit more about himself.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it. So, yeah, that's in a nutshell who I am and where I come from.
Oh, man. Episode's over.
Yeah, that's it. You nailed it, dude.
Nah, man. I try to give a premise on everybody that's on the show. And I think your premise is really good, man, because you do not know. Well, you probably do know, actually. So before I did this podcast, I used to photograph, do videography and stuff like that. And dude, I'm like nobody in this. I just knew some people down here for like exotic cars, supercars, and I knew some of the car clubs, and I would go to these events, and you know, you have random people coming up to me like, hey man, how can I do what you're doing? Or how can I get into this? And I'm like, you're asking me? So you do not know how many people are always like, hey, I mean, I'm sure you know, because I'm sure you get asked that a whole bunch of times, like, how can I get into photography? How can I get into editorial? How can I get on this magazine or on this online? Mm-hmm. Or how can I work with this brand? So it's great to have you on because you can share that insight with us. So
sure,
let's start from the beginning, right?
Cool.
Back in Pittsburgh, 2007 came. What made you actually go out to let's start a little bit before that, man. Your passion for cars, when did that start?
Well, you know what? It's funny because I, before I moved out here. I'd been working as a freelance photographer and a writer in kind of like a lot of the enthusiast editorial titles. Back then, it was mainly Modified Magazine, Pass Mag. You know, those guys were up that way. They were based out of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing some stuff for like some of the other Prime Media titles, which was the company that owned Super Street and Motor Trend and Turbo and those magazines back then.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, I got into cars maybe just right before that. I got into writing and photography first for skateboarding, actually. I always wanted to be a skateboarding photographer or an editor for a skate mag. Yeah. And then like, you know, I didn't have living in Pittsburgh. We didn't have a huge skateboarding community. We had some really, really talented people out there, but it just wasn't, I wasn't exposed to it enough. But a couple of my friends from skateboarding started getting into cars back in like the late 90s, mostly like Honda Civics and 240s and things like that, mostly drag racing, some like stereo stuff and, you know, and this, that, and the other. But that's kind of what got me into cars. And then there was actually a pretty decent car scene out that way for imports. And, you know, I just decided to start shooting them. And then once I, started shooting them and learning about them, I started becoming fascinated with, you know, just how they work and what makes them so fast compared to the old V8 hot rod recipe that was so popular. And I think it just kind of went from there. I just started shooting some local events. I went out to the drag races in New Jersey a few years. So English Town, Atco Raceway, everybody knows those. And, you know, back then they were just huge and that was the thing. So just being out there, I started sending photos off to the magazine editors, started shooting on film actually. So I would physically mail them slides and be like, "Hey, do you want to run this coverage?" Yeah. It was old school, but that's what started it. And then, you know, I made a couple of contacts there. And social media back in the day was like Flickr, MySpace. So I had a bunch of my work on those sites and then more people saw it and just kind of how it went. And then I started writing articles. And then I had a friend who was an art director for Importuner, also a photographer. And he was the one that put me up for the editor job at Importuner, which is a technical editor. So I interviewed for that in 2007, flew out here and just decided I wanted to do it.
Nice, man. So you got offered the job in 2007 and you just flew out there. You were just like, you know what? I'm there.
Yeah, man. I always wanted to live out here. You know, going back to the skateboarding days, this is where it was. And, you know, I went out and it was, I didn't have a lot in Pittsburgh. I mean, I had a good family, of course, good friends, you know, I didn't want to leave them, but I really wanted to try this. And I figured if I do it for a year, 2 years, you know, if it catches on, I'll stay. If it doesn't, I'll come back. I really didn't think it was going to stay that long, to be honest. So I just, I loaded up my Integra, drove across the country and, I never left.
Wow, man. That's awesome. Yeah. Man. So you definitely, dove in head first and you were like, let's see where this takes me, or not actually, let's see where this takes me. I'm going to grab that bull by the horn and we're going to go all the way, basically.
Pretty much, man. And I'll be perfectly honest. I was so uncomfortable doing it. You know, like, I mean, I was only maybe 25 at the time, which isn't super young, but mm-hmm. I never took any big risk like that before. So I was just, you know, I had a couple $1,000 saved up maybe. And I was like, you know, screw it. I got a job waiting for me. You know, granted, it didn't pay a lot, but I had a roommate. I had everything lined up. Nice. You know, I mean, worst that could happen was I'd go bust and come home. But, you know, I'd already done that how many times before that point. So I figured, why not?
Awesome, man. So you moved over there at 25. So when did you actually start shooting? Were you shooting like the skateboardings, like back in like high school? Or did you pick it up a few years before that? When did that start?
You know, I was always into skateboarding ever since I was a kid. That was my thing all through high school was skateboarding. I played drums too, so I was in a marching band. But I mean, I skated every day from like 14 to, you know, probably like my mid 20s. And, you know, I loved it. And I just made a lot of friends along the way. And I got a couple my first camera was from a guy who was a skateboarding photographer out there. And then, you know, so I used to just kind of fool around with it, but I never did anything. I never had any paid work through skateboarding photography. Yeah. You know, I kind of put that away when I went to school and I was bartending for a while, saving up some cash. And then, you know, it kind of cooled off for a couple of years. And then I got into cars and I started thinking one day, like, I'm just going to get a digital camera. I'm going to go to these events, start shooting, and then, you know, write the coverage up if anybody asks. And that's just kind of how it started.
Nice, man. And when did you actually start like shooting cars? Was it when you first purchased your car, or were you doing it before that or after that?
Before that. Yeah, I had a couple of beaters just as like daily drivers. But nice. I think that was 2005 I got that camera. I remember the day exactly. I bought a camera. It was an EOS 20D, and I bought some Dell laptop with like, I don't know, 512 gigs of RAM maybe, you know, and it was like fully specced out too. So this was like a $1,700 laptop that's laughable by today's standards. Yeah. So I was like, man, I was all nervous about spending the money. I'm like, do I really want to do this? And I'm going to spend like $2,200 or something. I was all freaked out by it. But that was 2005.
But it worked out, and it was an investment for the future.
Yeah, it definitely worked out.
Oh, nice, man. So that was 2005. So in 2005, you start shooting the car scene over there in Pittsburgh. And you mentioned PazMag. So I know I've heard of PazMag. I've actually seen the magazine and also online. So how did you get your work? How did you go from shooting the car scene to actually being able to contribute to magazines or to online publications at that time?
Yeah, it was really just going to the events. So back then it was like, you know, sport compact drag racing was big. So we had NHRA, NDRA, and, you know, they would go to all the racetracks on the East Coast, which were only like maybe a 5-hour drive for me, tops. So I would go out there and shoot a bunch of those. And I think maybe the first year I just kind of shot everything for myself, you know, just to learn it. And then like probably 2006 or so is when I must have bought that camera and laptop in 2005. I think, yeah, 2005, 2006. I started sending some photos off to the editors just cold. Like I would just put them in an email. The first couple of times was slides. So I would just drop slides into an envelope and send them out, you know, and be like, you know, do you guys want to run this? And I think I got like two rejections. And then Scott Oldham, who I think is at Edmonds now, was at Sport Compact Car at the time. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, you know, we'll scan these and do a web article, you know, and I'll cut you a check, which was really for nothing, but it kind of covered the expenses.
Okay.
And I was excited, man. I was like, oh my God, I got published. So I started putting that on all my social media profiles and, you know, started doing more photos later on when I got into digital. And I think just through the nature of networking, I met a couple guys who were also shooters. And then I met a couple editors, you know, who liked my work enough to ask me to go to different things. So kind of a mix between drag racing and hot import nights back then.
Wow, nice. So yeah. So then you were making these connections, and quite honestly, you were just sending it out to the editorial, I guess, email at all the magazines, right?
Basically, yeah.
Nice.
It was that simple. I used to search MySpace for, you know, people who were affiliated with magazines and then send them messages or emails or something like that. And that's just kind of how it started.
Nice, man. So definitely making it happen.
Yeah.
You had to go out and get it yourself.
That's the thing, man. You really can't sit around waiting for people to come to you because, you know, they're busy doing other stuff, living their life. So you really, like, every opportunity I've ever had, I feel like it was a result of me just going out to somebody super cold and uncomfortably and being like, you know, can we work together? And 30% of the time they'll be like, yeah, sure. You know, 70% of the time they got something else going on, but that's just how it goes.
Yeah. It's a numbers game. Like the more people you reach out to, the more no's you'll get, but you will get that one or two. Yes.
100%.
Definitely, man. Awesome, man. So thanks for sharing that with us. Now,
you
did mention something that I want to kind of touch on. You said you loaded up your Integra. Let's talk about that Integra, man. Because I was a big Honda head back in the days.
Yeah. So the first car that really ever got me into cars was my friend Chris Simpson's GSR. He bought this thing probably in 98 or 99 immediately had like one of those rev hard turbo kits or drag turbo kits or something.
Ooh,
you know, and this thing was probably like 250 to the wheels. And that thing just was the fastest car I'd ever been in. And I was like, holy shit, this is what these cars can do. This is awesome. You know? And I was hooked.
That's so awesome, man.
Yeah, I had a bunch of silly cars. I had a 95 Civic Coupe for a while that I did an LS engine swap in and put nitrous on it. Ooh. Used to take that to the drag strip. Okay. And then that thing got crashed into, and then I parted it out. And I kind of got out of cars myself for a while I finished up school and did the bartending. Mm-hmm. And then right around the time I got that digital camera, I decided to get, I found a really good deal on a, was it a 94 Integra LS mm-hmm. that okay. had been pieced together by a guy who owned a junkyard and used to just restore Hondas. And that was basically his whole thing. And it was a clean title, but you know, it had an engine from one car and doors from another and you know, whatever, mm-hmm. but it was cheap and it ran. And I kept it bone stock for like 2 years while I drove out to all these races and stuff. And then at one point I was like, you know, I might as well just start working on this thing. So I took it all apart right before I moved out. I took it all apart, rebuilt the trans, painted it, put a couple of ricey parts on it that I'm not too proud of today. But,
but that we've was all the been, thing, you know? We've all been through that.
Oh man. I've definitely been there, but it was fun. It was clean. It was running well. And then, you know, I loaded that thing up and drove it out. And then for a couple of years when I was at Import Tuner, that was one of our project cars. We would do all these like, you know, test parts on it and do tech articles with it and things like that. And I still have it. It's in my garage parked on jack stands where it's been for like the last 3 years.
Wow. Yeah. So you still have it. That's crazy. Mm-hmm.
I still want to make a track car out of it. And I, you know, it's on its way. I just don't really have time to deal with it right now, but that's the plan. As long as I can hold on to it, I'm going to. It's not worth it to sell it. Yeah. You know, I have history with it.
That is true. Although I was going to say that Integras have made a comeback. Before, I think I bought, because I used to be all into Integras. I did have a few like Civics, and right now I have a Civic Type R. But
nice.
But that's what started it out. Like, obviously, when I was younger, it was like, oh, the Integra Type R, Integra Type R. That's what that was like the car, like the unicorn that you want to freaking chase. Mm-hmm. So I had all these Integras. And
no shit.
I remember buying them for like, I don't know, $7,000, because I've had like a few of them. And right now, you go on like OfferUp or wherever, even eBay, and they're still going for the same $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, maybe even more for like the ones that are like very rare. Like if you find mm-hmm. like a nice little GSR that's supposedly, mm-hmm. and I'm doing air quotes, never has been touched, or is like bone stuck. Oh, uh-huh. You're definitely paying like over $10,000 for that. So they're keeping or. They haven't kept their value, but they got their value back, let's say.
Easily. Yeah. And for a while there, it's funny because like these guys were coming up on these Integras. Because you got to remember too, like aside from the Type R, which they only did for a couple years here, mm-hmm. the GSR was like the top trim Integra.
Yeah.
So like definitely. A lot of people would go to a dealership and they wanted to get a car, you know, and they wanted to get like the best, cheapest Acura they could, which would be the Integra GSR. So a lot of people bought this car and like never beat on it. So for a while there, like during the Import Tuner days for me, you'd always hear these stories of people finding these Integras that are in great shape, you know, like never even a scratch on the VTEC cam lobe in some cases mm-hmm. that were like, you know, getting sold on Craigslist for like $2,000-$3,000. But, you know, like you said, those days are gone.
Definitely, man. You still find the little, the ones that you know are going to need a lot of work for like the $3,000 range around there. Mm-hmm. But you already know that that's not all that it's going to cost you. But
no, it's definitely not. And it's crazy the price of Type R's these days, man. Type R's are like,
man,
one of them sold, what was it? Bring a Trailer. Somebody sold them for like $60,000, I want to say, or maybe 90, something outrageous.
Yeah, I think so. But that was one. Was that the yellow one that they sold or was that the championship white?
I think it was yellow.
Okay.
But it had like, you know, no miles.
Yeah.
Own stock.
I don't know. Here, part of my Type R, we have like a Type R club down here mm-hmm. in South Florida, and one of the members has a yellow one, and mm-hmm. he paid a few thousand dollars for it. Like, mm-hmm. obviously, I think like close to 20, I believe he told me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't in perfect condition. It wasn't in bad condition, but it wasn't perfect, you know? So, you know, and like, that's like his baby. Like he has like two Type R's, and the Type R, the Civic Type R's are outside in his, in his driveway. His baby,
oh my gosh.
The Integra Type R is like tucked in the garage.
Yeah. So when you say you have a Type R, you mean like an FK8 or do you have like an EG6 or? something like that.
No, I have the FKA 2017. Yeah.
Dude, those are killer cars, man. And when they came out, that's another car that like a lot of Honda heads were like, oh, it's ugly. I don't like it. And then as soon as they started hitting racetracks, everybody was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, this is an actual killer, this car.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think it's like you either like, at least at the beginning, it was like you either liked it or you didn't, right? Some people didn't like the style and they thought it was way too aggressive. And like you said, it was like not until they saw the numbers that were coming out that they were like, oh, okay, well, you know, it's not that ugly anymore, or it's not that aggressive, or what do they call it, boy racer type of thing.
It's nuts, man. Yeah. Like, it's nuts how fast that changed too, because now, like, I don't know, it's rare to even see them on the road out here, but you know, I see a bunch at the racetrack and they are fast. They're legitimately quick. And I know a lot of guys who are not the best drivers who are fast in those cars, you know, and some guys who are good that are just breaking records. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, man. I mean, there's so much that you can do to it. And it's crazy. I mean, I'm still using it more as a daily driver, let's say. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the plan. Get it up there.
What color did you get?
Able to use it at the track. Well, this is my second one. So I have a championship white one right now. Nice. My first one was a crystal black pearl, mm-hmm. and yeah, I wanted to get it was between the Sonic Gray Pearl or the championship white. And I went with the championship white. I mean, you can't go wrong with that, with the original color, with one of the original colors.
Yeah, no, those are the ones I would go for too, for sure.
Yeah, man.
That's a future classic too. You know, that car, I don't know how many they're going to make, but they're not going to make a ton. So I think that, like, you know, if we have the same conversation in another 20 years, we're going to be like, oh man, you have an FKA Type R. Holy shit.
Yeah, but only if you keep it and you keep it, try not to do too much to it, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, that's always how it goes.
Yeah, totally. Hey, or make it reversible, you know.
That is true. You keep all your parts to make it reversible.
Yeah.
So, dude, you, okay. So your Integra Type R was like one of the project cars at Import Tuner. You worked at Import Tuner. What happened after that? Because I definitely want to get into that.
Yeah, definitely. So I was there for 4 years from 07 to 11. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I started off as a technical editor, which means I just did a lot of the regular monthly columns like Fact or Fiction, where we would test performance products on the dyno.
Okay.
Or the racetrack, you know, and then I did a lot of like the technical editing in the magazine. And then staff started cutting back because, you know, social media was ramping up, digital was ramping up, mm-hmm. and then print was starting to just get hit, you know, over and over. So once we lost a couple people on staff there, then I kind of transitioned more into shooting features. So I was doing a lot more shooting and writing. And it was like around that time when I really realized that's something I like. You know, I'm getting better at it at the time, and I really enjoyed doing it. The tech stuff is fun, but I don't know, man. I don't have a passion for getting my hands dirty. Like, I like to do it occasionally, mm-hmm. but I'm just not one of those people that just lives in the garage and loves it. Yeah. You know, it's just not my style. But so I started doing more of the features, and then maybe it was late 2011. I had a friend from the magazine days who was a project manager, I think, or like a digital group director at Mazda's ad agency. Mm-hmm. And she mentioned that they were looking for somebody to kind of like come in and help, you know, jumpstart the brand's social media channels. Cause at the time they never had a social media effort. This was like right when, I guess, monetization in Facebook was starting to kick off. Instagram wasn't around yet, or maybe it had just started.
Okay.
So, you know, they were looking for somebody, and they were thinking it would be more of like an editorial background. So like the enthusiast media and that sort of world would come over into the social media space. So I got offered that job in 2011. Nice. And, you know, as much as I loved the magazine, the days were numbered and I just felt like that was the move to make. So I did that.
Wow, man. So they wanted more of like a social media or like a photographer, editorial, or they wanted all of the above?
Well, they wanted all of the above, and it was fun, you know, because I had free reign and I didn't have a lot of budget. There was really no budget carved out for social back then. But you know, it was cool. Like, there was really no oversight either. So we could basically do whatever we wanted, you know, which was fun. So we could go to car shows and talk about the Mazdas, or we could take a tour of Mazda's Motorsports Museum, which is kind of a small one that they have here in Irvine. But it's really fun. If anybody gets a chance to check that out, it's a good time. But like all these weird little projects, any idea we had, we thought would be cool. We'd pitch it. If it got accepted, we'd do it. You know, so it was a lot of fun. And it was really interesting too, because the brand was big enough that we had representatives from every one of those social companies. So we really got to learn the inner workings of, you know, of everything from the algorithms to the marketing platforms to, you know, where they saw social media going. And back then it was really insightful to see that stuff happening as it was growing.
I'm sure you guys did a lot, because that's how I remembered you. Like, I know I reached out to you at the conference, and I was like, Luke, I know Luke. And that's aside from your motorsports photos and what I seen there, but I've associated you with Mazda. And that's where like the name rang a bell. So that's awesome, man. And you definitely were you part of it. It was obviously after the whole little zoom thing, but
yeah. You know what? Actually, that was exactly where it happened too, because that was when Mazda was still kind of under the Ford umbrella, and there was an agency out of Detroit that was kind of running Mazda. And, you know, it wasn't really fully fleshed out. They never really had the attention the brand needed. But then whenever they, I guess, divested from Ford, then there was a push by Mazda corporate, aside from Ford, to have their own agency and to ramp up their own social sites and to change the brand and to lose Zoom and go more for like the Skyactiv line of products, which they're still kind of doing now.
Yeah, definitely.
So around that time.
That new Mazda 3, man, is I'm hearing good things about it. So they're definitely, Mazda's still definitely doing some good things, man.
It's cool, man. I mean, I have a mix of, you know, a lot of good times with the brand. And there were some frustrating times too, because they had their growing pains, and social media had its growing pains. But I mean, the products are great. They really, you know, everybody likes to say that they're innovative and groundbreaking and all these things, but you know, Mazda really did do like a ground up redesign of everything on like the product line. And I mean, it's better now than it ever has been, I think.
Yeah, man, definitely. No, at least now, because obviously before, like, you would only know Mazda because of the Miata, right? Mm-hmm. And now, like, their offerings, like, what they're offering is really nice, man. And even before, like, some things that they got rid of, like, you know, you still keep hearing, even on the SUV end, you still keep hearing good things about the CX-5, CX-7, CX-9 when it was around, and stuff like that. So, man, that's awesome. So, what happened after that? Sorry.
Oh no, I'm just going to elaborate a little bit on that. Yeah, so we worked on the launch of the CX-5, and then we worked on the launch of the Mazda 6 and the Mazda 3 when I was there, and that's when those products got completely redesigned. And it was fun. And when I started, it was still like the tail end of Zoom, so we were still doing like these fun little enthusiast activations, and we were working with people that you might know. Heath Patterson is one guy. He's from Florida. Okay. He did Mazda Movement, which was kind of like a series of social groups and communities and things. Mm-hmm. There's a guy named Paul Thomas who's still around. He was down in, I think he's in Florida also. So we used to work with these guys as influencers. Okay. And then when the brand switched products, we kind of went more towards the bigger campaigns and, you know, national campaigns and things like that. And, you know, Mazda had always been into racing, but they really kind of started to double down a little bit on it when they were doing the whole brand pivot. And, you know, I started going more to the meetings with these Mazda Motorsports guys and learning about racing at the IMSA level and some of the series that they were doing, like the Road to Indy. And then that's where I really started to, you know, really develop a passion for racing. And that's kind of what, you know, led me to want to, I guess, part ways with the brand and just get out on my own and do more of it for myself.
Nice, man. That's awesome. And then from there, then you started, obviously, LukeMunnell.com. And you have these, like, amazing photos on there, man. Like,
Thanks, man.
You take at the IMSA, at the and I know it's IMSA, but at these places, it's like, it's like, wow, man, it's like, they're like really top notch. So how was that move for you going from that, from working with this ad agency, working with Mazda, to just going out on your own and just making it happen? Yeah. Well, you already did it, but how was it after the fact?
You know, it's funny. It felt a lot like it did when I moved out here for the first time. You know, there's a lot of anxiety that comes with severing that cord, you know, having to let go of your safety net a little bit. Yeah. And it was the same kind of thing. Like I was living paycheck to paycheck when I was at the Mazda agency. They paid me well. I don't know where my money went. I had a bunch of long distance relationships that were, you know, just draining my bank account. And I don't know, man, I just wasn't very fiscally responsible. Mm-hmm. And once I got on my own, that became a reality very fast. I realized that, you know, you really have to do things like keep a schedule, keep a book, keep your accounting, you know, like just, you have to like, I kind of had to reinvent myself just to be more diligent about that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, it's as much as I wanted it to be getting out shooting every day, it was shooting once a week and then spending the remaining 6 days behind a computer, you know, just doing marketing or making connections or keeping up with all the clerical stuff, you know?
Definitely.
So that was the biggest transition, but it was also a learning curve too. Like I thought, you know, I'd always considered myself being a decent photographer and a good writer, but the more I went out there and realized I needed to sell my skills versus just do it as a component for a job, the more I realized there's a lot to learn, you know? Like every time I go out, I was learning something. I'm still learning something every time I go out.
Yeah.
You know, and there was that too. So, I mean, if I could characterize it, I would say it was those two things. It was just having to be more responsible and just having to always reconsider my work and question if I could do it different or better.
Wow, man. That's awesome, man. No, that is true, man. Like, you know, there's definitely things that, like you said, a safety net that you're always going to be anxious about. You're always going to be, I wouldn't say scared, but at least worried about, you know, about going on your own. But if you do the right things and learn from your mistakes, I guess, you're going to find a way. You know, it's kind of like that fight or flight mentality. You're either going to fight through it or, well, you know, well, there's always going back, you know, to another thing. So that's awesome, man.
There's always a way. I think what it takes is like, you know, for anybody interested, this is probably my favorite part of these kind of discussions is talking about this kind of stuff, you know, like the bootstrapping new businesses and that kind of stuff. I really like that. And, you know, the thing I think I realized the most is you have to live within your means and you have to, you know, not that it's that you shouldn't feel the pressure to do well. You always should, but you should be prepared for a very humble baseline and then you should hope for the best. So for like, man, maybe like the first 4 or 5 years I was on my own. I lived in this crappy little apartment in Lawndale, which is not too far from Redondo Beach, but you know, kind of a bit of a seedy neighborhood. And I had a roommate, sometimes a guy on the couch, and rented out some garage space. And I kept my rent low. I kept my expenses low. And I just tried to reinvest money into my business and my processes as much as I could and really try not to spend it. You know, I did a lot of food for less shopping, a lot of cooking at home, but, you know, those are the kind of things that you have to do to, you know, to get out there.
Yeah, exactly, man. It's always, what's the priority? Is it going out and eating or going and spending your money or in, like you said, investing in yourself and, you know, looking out for your future in the long run?
Yeah. And when you start looking at spending money as an investment, when you start looking at money as a resource base, then it really changes your perception of it. You know, you really don't care too much about flaunting whatever minimal wealth you have. You know, it's more important to you to invest it. And, you know, that's something I think everybody should consider. I think most people probably do consider that, even if they never go into business for themselves. But it just kind of took me making that leap to really get it.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Yeah, definitely. And that's when you actually knew, like, okay, this is what I got to do, and this is how I'm going to get it done.
Pretty much, yeah. And then, you know, as far as the work goes too, when I left Mazda, I was into the racing. Yeah. And, you know, I knew some people in that world. So I just started thinking, you know, how do I get to do more of this? You know, who's buying these images? Who's in the market for it? You know, who can I make these pitches to? You know, what kind of deliverables do I need to give them? You know, what quality are they looking for? You know, how prompt and timely do I have to be? And all the elements that go into it, you know? So I think I kind of started there, and then I got into doing some advertising work, which is, you know, a lot different than racing. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of editorial stuff too. I still do. So I think like, you know, my early income when I started out on my own was just a mix of those three things.
So I went on your website, right, when we first spoke, and I saw your post. It was really good, man, about 2020 and how you sent out your brochure to like a bunch of people, and then COVID happened.
Yeah.
And I took a look at the brochure, man. I'm like, wow, like these images, these photos, man, they're awesome. So how was that, man? Now that you were talking about that, one, how was you getting out there and getting that work, being able to sell that brochure or advertise that brochure to different companies, different people? And then two, how did that work out after COVID hit, man?
It's funny, man. I should have seen it coming, because I try to stay informed. You know, I skim through the news at least every day before I go to bed. And like, I don't know, man. I'd been through this a couple of times before with the swine flu and a bunch of the other overseas scares that, you know, we've had, Ebola and whatever. But I just thought this was going to fizzle out, you know. So I prepared for 2020 like it was going to be any other year. Mm-hmm. And I sent those mailers out. And initially I got a good response. I got a lot of teams that were like, you know, this is good stuff. Let's talk about working together this season. And then I swear in like a month after people started reaching those is when everything shut down. Mm-hmm. And then nothing happened for like 3 months. So then I started getting back into people, and then everything had changed. Like people's travel plans had changed, their budgets had changed, and there was a lot of uncertainty, you know? So I think I had 2.5, you know, 2 steady clients and 1 part-time client for IMSA last year. And, you know, I tried to get somewhere around 6 or 7. So I wasn't really making money off the races. I'd make a little bit. I'd cover my expenses. I probably could have stayed in and did something else and made more, but I felt like it was important to stay out there. So I went to all the races when they started back up in maybe July. Actually, not July. I think it was closer to like September, October.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. It was some places you go to, business as usual. Other places, everybody's locked down. You know, so you really got to, and I went to Wisconsin. I went to Florida twice, Georgia, a couple places in California, Virginia, you know, so I got to see like a good snapshot of the country while this whole thing was happening, you know, and a lot of the areas where it wasn't hitting yet, people generally didn't, you know, weren't living in fear of it. In other areas where it did hit, like New York, everybody was afraid of it. Nothing was happening.
Yeah.
You know, so it was interesting. I think though, like most people probably just had it in their minds that they needed to just stick to their guns and keep working, keep moving, you know. And I think most people knew there was some risk involved, but for the most part, they felt like it was riskier to not do anything.
Yeah.
You know, for their careers and business initiatives and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and you saw like some stuff coming, like you said, like around September, October, like some things were starting to open up. And because I remember I was trying to go to, I don't know if it was IMSA or some other event over there in the Sebring Raceway from Florida that was supposed to happen in July, and then it got delayed. And they delayed it, I think, to August, and then I think it got delayed again. So needless to say, I didn't end up going.
Yeah.
But I think it actually like happened like in November. So yeah, it's like eventually they were like, man, we can't delay this again. Like we can't postpone it again. We have to actually do it. Let's just, well, like you said, like either they did it in a safe way or they were just like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing with racing and events is like a lot of these things stay in motion because you have brand partners and you have advertisers and you have sponsors and these things. And those commitments to those sponsors and advertisers had already been drawn out for the year.
Yeah.
So there was almost a case where the show had to go on because all these racing series owed it to their partners to deliver, you know? So if they had to do what Formula D did and stuff, you know, doubleheader events into just four stops on the calendar, that's what they did, you know, and IMSA, they crowded, you know, the rest of their season into the last couple months of the year.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I'm sure the return for those partners wasn't as good as it could have been. You know, their fan attendance was zero in some cases and very low in others. And I think, where it was televised or broadcast, they probably did pretty well, but it was a strange year. And like in any event, they had to spend those budgets and make good on the promises. But 21 is even a little different because a lot of those budgets just didn't happen. You know, a lot of teams just aren't going to race this year. A lot of events just aren't going to happen, you know? So I think that this year is going to be the slow year, to be honest, I think in a lot of regards, and hopefully next year, things will really start to come back.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, yeah, like with all the vaccines and whether you believe in the vaccine or not, like hopefully, whether it's the vaccine or something else, like hopefully we're able to get back to normal-ish, because I don't think we'll be back to normal for a long time, but at least heading in that direction, you know, a little bit more than where we are now. So
I think so. I think we're starting to get a better understanding of this, and you know, we do have the treatments and vaccines out there, and I think people understand what they need to do to stay as safe as they can. Yeah. And at the same time, a lot of people are starting to realize, like, you know, I can take all those steps and still get on with my life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people are getting over it. And I think that, I mean, barring anything crazy that we've never seen before, I think this thing will run its course in the next, you know, 12 to 24 months tops.
Thanks for all of that, Luke. I mean, your insight, man, into the industry, into the photography industry has been awesome. I want to kind of segue or go into the what I like to call fast track questions, right? These are just three questions I'm going to throw out at you and want to see what your answers will be. All right.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right, man. So I'm not going to let you use your Integra, okay? But what was that one car that has impacted you the most in your automotive enthusiasm, your passion for cars?
You mean like a particular make model or like a very particular car?
It could be either one, quite honestly, because I have had some people that, you know, that, for example, I interviewed somebody else that was like, you know, when I saw that, when I first saw that Chevy Camaro, whatever. So you make the choice. You let us know.
Yeah. Man, there have been a couple. Is it okay if I give you a couple?
Sure.
Okay. So my friend's Integra back in the day was the first one for sure. And it, you know, wasn't anything crazy past a bolt-on turbo kit, but that was like pivotal in my whole role with cars, you know, so.
The 250 horsepower one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Nice. Yeah, but it sounded cool.
Hey, man, for Integra back then, you know, it was definitely, it wasn't the fastest thing out there, but it was definitely a start.
Yeah, definitely. That's one. And then I remember like maybe 2003, I had this 240 that I bought and I did an SR swap in 2002 or three. Nice. And the whole reason I decided to do that was we were sitting around a couple of my friends one day watching those old, what was it? Not Top Gear, Top Secret, those Top Secret JDM videos.
Okay.
And Smokey Nagata had this R34 Skyline that he hit like 215 miles an hour in some tunnel in Japan.
Wow.
And that was the coolest thing any of us had ever seen. I mean, we got this thing. Somebody got their hands on a copy not long after it came out. We didn't even know what was on this DVD. And we saw that and we're like, oh my God, this is what they're doing in Japan. It was crazy, you know, and that car definitely was very pivotal too, I think.
Okay.
And then the final one I think would be the Mazda 787B. That's the Le Mans winner from 91. And when I was at the agency, that came over here for the Motorsports Reunion in Monterey, I think in 2011. And I got to shoot a little feature of it. And the photos from that feature really kind of put me on the map as far as a lot of agencies and a lot of social influencers and things like that. I still get calls about it. You know, hey man, you shot the 787B. Those photos are great. You know, can I get a high res, you know, whatever. So it's definitely that car too. And that car is just an amazing car. It represents so much in terms of that race effort that Mazda had back then, which is just historic by anybody's standards.
Yeah, man.
I love everything about that car, man. It's a sick car. Awesome
that's
effort.
An amazing car, you know? Man. Yeah.
So cool.
Did you get to did you just shoot it or did anything, did they let you do anything with the car? Anything else?
And it's funny. I didn't know. We had to push it around and shoot it because had to fly a guy in from Japan the next day to start it. The brand didn't want anybody else to touch the car or start it or prime the fuel or anything. They had a guy that went through this whole procedure with a laptop to get this thing to run. And so I didn't even get to hear it run. I didn't get to see it run. I had to leave the next day too. I had to do something else.
Oh, man.
So I still sucks. Never, seen it, but I did get to shoot it.
Nice, man. That's awesome, man. So that is a great list of cars that have definitely impacted you, man. So thanks for sharing that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Especially that 787B.
Love that thing.
Kind of sidestepping over, and you know, some of those cars might be in this list. But next question is: you have a 3-car garage. We'll leave it at 3, and you can only have 3 cars, but you have unlimited funds. What 3 cars would be in those garage spaces?
Oh man. That's a tough one, man. I think I always liked the Carrera GT.
Okay.
I always thought that was a good, solid road car that maybe shouldn't be a road car, but I'm glad that it is. I think that would be there.
That's a nice pick.
Yeah. I think a Ferrari F40 too. That's kind of like that halo car that I'll never, ever own. But same thing. It's like a kind of a race car for the street. Just so essential and perfect in so many ways. That's definitely in there too.
Okay. So you got a Carrera GT. You got a F40 Ferrari.
Mm-hmm. And the last one I think I got to do something kind of enthusiast based. I think I'm going to go back to Japanese for a second and say I would do a 4-rotor RX-7 FD.
Oh, nice, man.
Yeah.
So the FD is the 93-97 one.
Yeah.
The 90s one. Yep. Nice, man.
Yeah.
Or the late 90s one. So let's say, yeah, the good one.
Yeah.
That's nice, man. That's a pretty nice car, man.
That's my garage.
That's an awesome
garage.
Yeah,
the 4-rotor engines. Yeah. Yeah, those 4-rotor engines are nuts, man. That's what's in the 787 and a bunch of the old 90s Mazda Le Mans cars. But those things just sound incredible. You know, they're so simple too. But yeah, I love it. My favorite engine. Yeah.
Nice, man. All right. Yeah. So you gave us your 3-car garage. It's a great garage as well. Let me say that. Now, pivoting over to our last question. All right.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a list of 3 cars, and we're going to play Track Daily Crush. Have you ever played this?
No.
Okay.
I'm a little nervous. I don't want to crush any of them if I have to.
So you already kind of know the premise. One of them has to be your track car. Yeah, yeah. No, okay, you're assuming well. One of them has to be your track car. One of them has to be your daily car. And the other one you got to send to a junkyard to get crushed. So ultimately, you're going to end up with 2 cars. Now.
Okay.
Your list. Oh, by the way, these are your only 3 cars. So it's going to turn into 2 after the third one gets crushed. But your list of 3 cars are, we're going to do this. I usually like to go the center. No, you know what? I am going to use that sentimental one. So we're going to use your Integra.
Oh, man.
Done up and all that. Once you do it.
Okay.
Okay. So you're ready. It's not on the jack stands.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do the RX-7 FD.
Mm-hmm.
And cool. You know what? Let's throw in there that 787B.
Oh, man. Okay. Oh, that's easy then. Okay. Well, kind of easy.
I don't know.
Ah, no, it's not easy. Nah, it's tricky. Damn. Okay. Well, so is this a normal world where, like, the laws of physics apply and reliability and all that, or not really?
Not really.
Okay, cool.
Let's say you can kind of drive any car, track any car, and essentially crush any car. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the 787B scares me, I think, to drive on the track. I've never driven anything even remotely close to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, it's not a good daily. I think I might actually try to keep that. I'll keep that as a track car.
Okay.
And I'll keep my my Outlaw Integra as my daily.
Oh.
And as much as I like that four-rotor FD, I think I might just have to crush it.
Okay. Wow.
I know, because I'll have a four-rotor race car anyway. So
that is true.
Might as well.
And you already have a track car.
Yeah. Then I could daily the Integra again. I did it for a while. It'd be a lot more fun if it was built. So yeah. I think maybe that's...
Although you are building it for a track car as well.
I am. I would like to drive it on the street, but, you know, it's not going to be legal in any sense of the word. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's
I have to go with it. Yeah.
That's a little twist. You know, I mm-hmm. honestly, at first I thought you were going to try to get rid of the 787B, mm-hmm. but you were saying that it scared you. So I was like, wow, he's really going to do that. He's going to get rid of it.
No,
and then never. And then I was like, wow, what is he going to go with at the end? But yeah, you cut the Integra, Sentimental Valley, so that's good.
Yep.
And you crushed that that RX-7. So bye-bye, FD.
Yeah. Sorry to see it go. You know, yeah. I feel like I never really knew it.
There you go. Thanks for playing, Luke. Those were some awesome answers. I really appreciate that, man. I know we're getting down to the last of it. We've been talking for a little while. I don't want to take up too much of your time. But
yeah, totally cool.
Wanted to get one more thing out of you. In the essence of everybody, you know, asking, I already think that you shared so much insight, so much great knowledge on how you yourself got into the industry, how somebody can, you know, essentially follow in your footsteps. But what is that one piece, or maybe more than one piece, but what is that last piece of advice that you would give somebody that does want to follow in your footsteps?
I think it's just there's two. Always be realistic. You know, you got to ask yourself what you can do, you know, where you can improve. And even before that, you have to ask yourself what people want, because nobody's in business just based on what they like to do. It always has to do with what somebody needs, what somebody wants. So you got to ask yourself, you know, among your skills, how are they marketable? You know, how can you make that valuable to anybody else? That's the first thing you got to ask yourself, I think. And then you got to start thinking about being realistic about what you can deliver, you know, what you can deliver when, and what you can add on to in the future. You got to be realistic about your timeline and your budgets and things like that. And you got to be realistic about your shortcomings too. You know, you have to think like, okay, I can do this, but is it going to be a lot of work? Am I prepared for that? You know, or should I do this other thing instead? I think those are that should always be kind of like the assessment process when people want to get into something new or start a business or, you know, go into business for themselves or something like that.
Nice.
I think that's the first part. Yeah. The second part, I think, would be, well, I think that's probably it. Yeah, I'm kind of drawing a blank on what the second one would be, but I think that probably covers it.
You left us hanging, Luke. What's going on?
I know. I had another one, but then once I talked about it, I think I might have covered it. So we'll just leave it there.
No, but
yeah, just be realistic.
All right. There you go, man. Those are great two pieces of advice, because you said the first one and the second one. So great pieces of advice, plus what you've already shared with us. So that's awesome, man. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you coming on, talking to me. I know we went a little bit over, Actually, a lot over, actually. From what doesn't I feel promised. Like it is. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking, I'm cool, looking at the time. I'm like, oh, man.
I appreciate
it. Good,
it
was a good conversation, yeah. Man.
Very good conversation, yeah. I like this kind of thing. Thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it. I wasn't expecting anything like this to come out of the conference, but I'm glad it did.
Yeah, man. No, I'm definitely glad I was able to talk to you and have you on the show. Thank you again, man. One last thing, where would people be able to reach out to you? I know lukemunnell.com, mm-hmm. guys.
Mm-hmm.
LukeMunnell.com. Definitely go on. Check out Luke's work. It is amazing. You will sit there in awe of these of these images. But where else can they make contact with you, Luke?
I'm pretty much at Luke Munnell all around the web on social media. I'm on Facebook, Instagram. You know, Instagram's probably I think the one that I use the most. Mm-hmm. I started a MeWe or Mayway account. You know, I don't know really how you pronounce that, but people are starting to get on that, so I figured I should get on there too.
Okay.
That's it. Or just you know, just reach out via email. I'm not too shy about that either. I'm just luke@lukemunnell.com.
Nice. So you guys said it. Yeah. You guys heard it here. Very easy. Just find Luke Munnell anywhere. Online, social there. Media, and even on the, if you want to send them an email. So definitely check it out. I implore you to do that, because if you haven't seen Luke's work, you're missing out. Definitely. So Luke, thanks again, man. And I appreciate you getting on. And, you know, I would like to do this again in the future sometime. So cool. We'll definitely stay in contact, man. Have you on again, because I know for a fact that people are going to have more questions. And they were like, man, you didn't ask Luke this, or you didn't forget about this. So definitely expecting that. And we'll stay in contact, man. So I can have you back on.
Let me know, man. I'm happy to do it. This is great.
All right, man. Well, you have a good night, Luke.
All right. Thanks, Lois. You too.
Thanks, man. Motor Mystery.